This is Suzanne Duplantis, and I'm the founder and artistic director of Lyric Fest, along with pianist Laura Ward. I'm here to speak for a little while with composer Melissa Dunphy. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
Melissa is one of 11 wonderful composers that Lyric Fest has commissioned to write new songs in celebration of Walt Whitman's bicentennial. We're presenting song settings, poetry, and biography of Walt Whitman in a Whitman celebration called Carol of Words. Part one is April 6th at 4 o'clock at the Academy of Vocal Arts. That's a Saturday. Part two is on Sunday, April 7th, 3 p.m. at Haverford College's Roberts Hall. Both performances feature a composer talk in the space the half an hour before the performance. Melissa, I'm going to introduce you to our audience for this podcast, and I think the first thing that people will notice is your accent. So let's put that to rest, and why don't you tell everybody where you're from and how you got here?
Okay, I am originally from Australia, and I live in America now, and I'm an American citizen because I met and fell in love with an American in my early 20s. Over a mutual love of Nine Inch Nails, actually, the rock band. And we've been married now for 15 years, so I know, which is amazing.
So you met in Australia?
Well, we were friends originally on the internet for a couple of years, and then I came on a vacation to the United States, and he and I ended up road tripping from York, Pennsylvania, which is where he lived, all the way down to New Orleans and back
up. I'm from New Orleans.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, my God. We have the biggest soft spot for your city.
Me too.
It is the city that made us fall in love.
That's awesome.
It was like magic. It was like...
It's special.
Yeah, like the universe and the whole city, like the city itself was telling us that this was the right path. And it ended up being absolutely the right path. We did the long distance relationship for a while and realized the only thing to do was to take the plunge, get married, and see what would happen. We were 23.
Wow.
And everyone thought we were nuts.
Wow.
And, but, you know, like I said, we just celebrated our 15th wedding anniversary. We've launched a podcast together. We're in a band together. And if those things can't tear a marriage apart, then I'm pretty certain we're on solid ground.
You're here to stay. That's awesome. So you're a composer who has not only your bio on your website, but you have a mission on there.
Yeah.
And I was very intrigued by this, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your mission as you see it.
Sure. When I built the website and I was thinking about how to present myself, you know, and there's always the typical composer bio that you see in programs, and it usually just ends up being a laundry list of achievements, which is fine. You know, it's important to see what you've done and who you've worked with and all of the accolades or education you've gotten. But to me, I wanted to tell people why I was a composer and what was the point of my work, because I want my work to continue in a particular direction. And also because there are some things that, as a woman working in the music industry, I get very hot under the collar about and want to see change. And I want to be someone who takes responsibility for helping that change along. So my mission as a composer is really to make choices about whose stories I tell and who I center in my work and who gets to tell those stories, and to make those choices in opposition to this patriarchal kind of narrative that we've had in Western classical music for hundreds of years. So I realized also, in my undergraduate degree that the world of singing in particular, which is I'm particularly drawn to because I love working with text and I love all of the nuances that the human voice can offer. In the world of singing, there are way more women than men in the workforce, if you will, as professional singers. And yet, in part because composition is still so male-dominated, We write for more men than women. We write operas with more male characters. There seems to be a rash of operas right now with all male choruses. And just from a personal perspective, I'm watching my soprano friends struggling to find work, getting furloughed from opera choruses. Mm-hmm. Some of the best musicians I know who have to be on food stamps because there isn't work for them to survive. And I realized as a composer that I have a lot of power in deciding, particularly in the vocal world, whether men or women get work.
Wow.
You know, so I sort of put that. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, it's true, right? It's so true. And I want to put that out there in part on my website to sort of signal to people who are interested in working with me or commissioning me.
This is where you are.
Yeah, that this is what I want to do. If you come to me with an idea that is part of the status quo, that is, you know, write something that's an opera about men for men.
Might not be something you're very interested in.
Yeah, I may pass on that idea.
Mm-hmm. Is there something, can you think of something that particularly inspires your creativity? Like, we know what you don't want to do, but so those stories about, is there something you're hoping to write?
Yeah. Oftentimes in my career, it's the stuff that I have the biggest emotional response to. I definitely, as a composer, am more attuned and more likely to follow through with ideas that really make me emotional in some way. Sometimes that's a sense of outrage at a particular situation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a sense of, you know, something that gave me an intense feeling of hope. I would say, What Do You Think I Fought For at Omaha Beach, which is a choral song I wrote about marriage equality, that the lyrics gave me this incredible feeling of hope that left me a puddle of tears on the floor. And so I said,
You knew you had to write about it.
Right. I have to turn it into music.
So in those situations, do you wait for a commission or you just immediately write?
It depends. I've been very lucky in that a lot of my work is along these lines. And so I often get commissioners coming to me and kind of saying to me, what's something that excites you? Write something about that, you know,
Perfect.
So I've had a lot of freedom in my commissions, and even things like sacred commissions. I'll often have a church choir come to me and say, you pick a text that fits into, you know, this gospel reading, and it can be whatever you want from the gospels. And so, or whatever you want that fits this theme, and I will be able to find the text that resonates with me and stirs my emotion. I know I've been very lucky.
Yeah. So Lyric Fest came to you with a very specific poet, with Walt Whitman. And I wondered, since you're not from America, whether you knew that poetic voice very much.
I did know. I was not a Walt Whitman expert, but I grew up in Australia in a past life, studying classical acting. And one of the things with classical acting is reading a lot of poetry out loud, recitation of poetry. Mm-hmm. And so I had encountered his poetry as part of these studies. Mm-hmm. But I probably, less than a lot of American composers, have that very identity backed love of Walt Whitman as America's poet.
Right.
Because I didn't grow up in America.
Yeah, so my next question, I wondered if there were obstacles to setting his poetry that you encountered.
Okay, yes.
Tell us about that. I wondered.
So when I first accepted the project, you know, actually primarily I was really delighted to work with Lyric Fest because I have many friends who've sung with Lyric Fest and have highly recommended that, you know, if you ever get the chance to work with them, you should totally work with them.
Oh, that's great.
They've spoken highly of you and Laura and working with you. So I was super excited and flattered to be asked to collaborate. And then, you know, my thought was Walt Whitman, I don't know that much about him, but I, you know, put that in a corner of my head and I'll think on that and see if I can. He's written so much poetry. Surely there's something that I will find that same resonance with. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's the obstacle. Walt Whitman, personally, was a racist. And this is documented, it's not something that actually a lot of Americans know about, mm-hmm. because they study Walt Whitman from a literature perspective, mm-hmm. and not necessarily from a biographical mm-hmm. perspective. So he's a man of many contrasts, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. You know, he was openly gay, mm-hmm. and he was very vocal in his works about ideas of liberty and seemingly about equality.
Democracy.
Mm-hmm. And freedom. Yeah, all of these things which, you know, fit with a modern sensibility of liberalism. But he also said some absolutely egregious things about African Americans in his writings. Mm-hmm. There is some analysis of his writings that suggests that he wasn't particularly inclined towards supporting women's rights either. And you know, okay, so one of the arguments is he was a man of his time. And I think 2 years ago, I might have accepted that explanation that he was a man of his time. But for reasons related to some history that I've been researching recently, I have been reading a lot about Quakers and mm-hmm. Philadelphia Quakers. And
which he comes from a line of Quakers.
Right. Mm-hmm. But what's astonishing is that Quakers, 100 years before the Civil War, were calling for the manumission of slaves and true equality for African Americans in America. They were, in fact, during the Revolutionary War, during the 1770s, kicking out Quakers who refused to free their slaves. Reading them out of the church, excommunicating them, essentially, from the Quaker church. So knowing all of this, and knowing that, you know, many within the Quaker movement had said slavery is inherently violent, and, you know, we need to welcome black people into our church. In fact, in Philadelphia, some of the first, you know, Quaker churches to welcome freed black men and women into their church, you know, this was right here in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And then to think that, you know, 100 years later, Walt Whitman is saying terrible things mm-hmm. about black people. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it's a point of dissonance,
sure,
in his story.
How did you overcome that?
Okay, so at first I was reluctant to think about, you know, how am I going to engage with this? So mm-hmm. I'm doing a lot of this research after I was tapped for the mm-hmm. for the commission, the project. Mm-hmm. and learning about this other side to Walt Whitman, and trying to figure out if I, as a composer who does a lot of political stuff, want to engage this side of Whitman, or if I want to ignore it. And actually, Lyric Fest provided the catalyst to answering that question, and that was when it was suggested to me that I have Rayon Bryce as my singer.
Yes.
You know, Lyric Fest originally said you can choose one of these mm-hmm. singers, you can choose the voice type that you want, and I did it a little bit because I wasn't sure what mm-hmm. how I wanted to approach his poetry, mm-hmm. and then Lyric Fest said, you should pick this singer, why don't you pick this one? And I went to YouTube, of course, right away to see if I could see Rayon singing.
You saw this beautiful African-American singer.
Yeah, this yes. beautiful African-American yes. singer with a voice so amazing that, I mean, after I watched some YouTube videos, I actually was so intimidated by writing for this incredible voice that I had to not compose the piece for a couple days because I was like, I can't start. I'm so intimidated by her voice. I'm so, you know, overwhelmed by the idea that she's going to be singing something that I wrote. Yeah. And then I thought, I can't ignore this now. I have to somehow address this issue. Mm-hmm. I took one of Walt Whitman's perhaps best known poems, Pioneers, O Pioneers. It's done the rounds. There's actually an old recording of an actor saying these words that has been used in like a Levi's commercial. Wow. You know, it's like one of these poems that is mm-hmm. in pop culture. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. so well known in his canon. And the song was originally about, when he says pioneers, oh pioneers, he's talking about white people in the West, mm-hmm. right? White men who are in the Western sun, you know, along the Western front, you know, going out to California. And it was a call to arms for the Civil War, because Walt Whitman was on the side of Lincoln and he wanted these young pioneers to take up arms and fight in the Civil War. But it begins with the line, "Come, my tan-faced children, follow well in order, get your weapons ready, for we must march, my darlings." Mm. And the whole first verse of it, until you get to the words, "Pioneers, oh pioneers," at the end of the verse, to my ears, it struck me, mm-hmm. what does tan-faced children mean to a modern audience?
Right.
You know, it means something very different in 2019 than I think it did when he wrote it.
Which is the fabulous thing about poetry.
Yes, absolutely. So there's sort of two sides to this. So I edited his poem, which I can do because it's out of copyright and right. he's long dead. So I cut
absolutely.
Some lines from his poem. And also yeah. because, you know, whenever yeah. a composer is setting mm-hmm. Walt Whitman, you have to edit some of his poetry.
Of
it's
course.
So long and
right.
nobody's going to mm-hmm. sit down for, I mean, mm-hmm. unless that was not the scope
25
of the project.
Minutes long.
Yeah. So I knew I would have to make some cuts anyway, but I cut the poem in such a way that these words coming out of the mouth of Rayon Bryce, mm-hmm. it's going to mean something completely different. When Rayon Bryce sings, "Come, my tan-faced children," that's a totally different message. I am sure if Walt Whitman were around to hear it, he would be spinning in his grave.
Or he might like it.
Well,
maybe he would have evolved in the...
Possibly, possibly. But, you know, I'm also yeah. of the opinion that...
it doesn't matter.
No, the original intent of an author is not really the point of art. We, you know, art goes... And I've experienced this myself as a composer. Art goes where it will, where it wills once you set it out into the world. Mm-hmm. It's like raising a child and then the child leaves the house. You lose control over what happens. You do your best, but...
Yeah, that's so interesting. And now just a little, maybe perhaps more mundane things.
Yeah,
can
sure.
you tell us about your process?
Okay.
How do you start? You told us you started with the poem.
I always start
Where
with
does the
lyrics.
Sound come in?
It's really, I think a lot of it, because as I mentioned earlier, I grew up with a tradition of speaking poetry out loud. Mm-hmm. I will often just speak the lines
just
of poetry.
Declaim the text.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to mm-hmm. myself, or often what I do is my apartment has a balcony in the back, mm-hmm. which is really close to I-95, the highway. And so if you go onto my balcony, you can speak and shout and nobody can really hear you in the neighborhood because
wow.
the highway is right there. Uh-huh. So I will go onto my balcony and I'll walk around and around in a circle and just wait till the melody comes. I think.
So it comes as a melody,
yes.
not necessarily a harmonic.
I am very melodic based
You're very, okay.
in my head. Yeah.
And does it come as a feeling of what you want the song? Like, do you get an idea of what you want the sort of atmosphere and sound world of the song to be, or that comes after the melody?
No, I think about the atmosphere first.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the beginning of this song, I think, is a call to arms and
mm.
is, I guess also I'm thinking sort of metaphorically that she starts off sounding like a brass instrument,
mm.
you know, sounding like a trumpet calling forth to her tan-faced children. So with that kind of atmosphere in my head, I'll think, well, what melody suits that? And what melody suits the text? What melody will serve both the text
mm-hmm.
and this idea? And then...
So she's like a priestess, like an invocating...
Yeah.
Invocation of...
Absolutely. So it starts with this uh-huh. rising fifth,
mm-hmm.
you know, which
mm-hmm.
is like this very brass thing
yeah.
to happen. And then once... I write melody first, and then I figure out what's happening underneath and around the singer quite
mm-hmm.
often. And then, you know, my process from that point is... It's kind of like building blocks. So I'll have the melody. I'll figure out what building blocks are under the melody. Perhaps the building blocks go a little further than the melody. And
mm.
that starts the process of the next phrase of the melody. It takes
mm.
us to the beginning of the next phrase of the melody. And so it's sort of each line of each part of the song, whether it's the piano or an instrument that goes or another voice, you know, depending.
Does it surprise you sometimes where it all ends up?
Yes.
Or do you kind of know?
You know, a lot of the time I don't know where it's going to end when I start a piece. Mm-hmm. I just assume that my brain is very good at figuring out how to recapitulate if I need to at the end of a piece. And so most of my pieces, I think, sort of come back to ideas to see if I can mine more, more feeling or change the feeling. The things that excite me as a composer are things like, can I revisit a melody, but now put that melody in a totally different context, you know, and then deepen the meaning of the text and the melody by taking a melody that was a call to arms and making it a soft lullaby. You know, can I do that? That's what really excites me as a composer.
So in our talk before, you talked about how you have an interest or a background in drama, you know, in storytelling.
Yeah.
So is this, are you, is storytelling a big part of what you want to do in life as a composer?
100%.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I actually primarily think of myself as a storyteller, even when the work that I'm doing doesn't necessarily have a strict narrative. Because music is a temporal format, there's always a narrative. You know, unless you're just writing something that's purely a drone and doesn't ever change, there's always a kind of narrative. And so for me, making that narrative clear to an audience is a really important part of what I do.
So you've described it a little way. One of my questions was, are you a fast composer or sort of a methodical composer? Oh. But
I'm
just curious.
Yeah, no. it really depends. I have done pieces where the entire piece just pours out of me in like 2 days, a day. And sometimes those pieces are the best, you know, sometimes, and it's really hard to control that. It's, you know, I don't want to sound too, you know, airy fairy woo woo, but it's like the muse that is talked of. It's a real thing for me.
Yeah.
I know some composers aspire to a 9-to-5 work day where they sit down in the morning and work methodically on a piece and then knock off and can, but for me, that's not like so that. Hard. Mm. Yeah, sometimes I'll be going to sleep and then, oh no.
I have to get up and go.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh no, yeah. Like something that I've been working on all day. It's like the pressure of needing to sleep has worked that idea through my brain and suddenly I have the answer. And I have to drag myself out of bed and go and write it down. Wow. Because I don't know if it'll be there in the morning.
And it probably won't be.
Right. So, yeah, it's hard.
Is there something that you're hoping that people will hear in your song?
In this particular song? If I had to be completely ambitious, I would hope that they have enough context thinking about where Walt Whitman was when he was writing his poetry and where we are now and what we've done with his words, to see the song as the journey of America, the ongoing journey of America, from an idea about equality and liberty, which were, you know, the foundation, the pillar stones of our country's ideology from the start, but were never successfully implemented, and we're always striving for that goal, I hope. And we're not there yet, but you know, here is how it evolves, here is how America has evolved, and here is how our society has evolved, and look how far we've come. But also, I think inherent in these words is the idea of look how far we have to go, because part of the lyrics here are, you know, you must bear
take up the battle of today,
right? You must bear the brunt of danger, which to me, you know, like I said, originally about white soldiers in the Civil War, now it's about Black people who are disproportionately killed by the police and imprisoned, incarcerated. You know, you must bear the brunt of danger. That is a really different meaning, but we're recognizing these things, you know, as we move forward. So fingers crossed.
I'm sure it will be. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it will be. That's such a powerful message. Mm. So thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you so much.
It's been thrilling to be able to talk to you, and we're just so happy to have you.
I'm so excited for the premiere and to hear Rayon.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm really excited.
Thank you. So this ends the formal part of our talk.
Mm-hmm.
However, for anybody interested, I'd like Melissa to talk a little bit about the other part of her life right now. Feel free to stop listening, but you might not want to. Tell us about your house.
Okay. this is the very, very short version the place where I live, where we're recording this interview right now.
Which is a gorgeous, gorgeous space.
on Callow Hill Street here in Philadelphia. In 2014, my husband and I were idly thinking about one day owning a house with a really large space that we could practice in, maybe even have some house concerts for our friends. I think we were in part inspired by Andrea Clearfield's salon, because it's totally
wonderful.
Amazing.
Yeah.
But also my husband's a drummer, and we have a ton of drum kits, and we have nowhere to put them. Yeah. We had nowhere to put them. So we were idly looking at real estate listings, and we saw a listing that was very strange. My husband found it. It said, studio apartment, 2,000 square feet and 3 bathrooms. So he was really confused. He clicks on it. The first picture was a row home. The second picture was a theater lobby, very clearly a theater lobby. And the third picture was a proscenium stage. And at this point, because I've done a lot of theater in Philadelphia, and my husband figured I would know what this space was, he called me in excitedly into his office where we lived and said, what is this space? And I said, I have absolutely no idea. Google it. Let's see what comes up. And it came up Grasso's Magic Theater, which had recently shut down because the owner had gone to jail. And the theater was about to go into foreclosure. And it was in this sort of tucked away spot in Philadelphia here, so next to I-95, but
almost to the river,
almost on the Delaware River, but 10 minutes walk from the Liberty Bell and 5 minutes from the Painted Bride Theater and the Fringe Arts building right here on the river. Mm-hmm. And we were so confused by this building, but also really excited. I remember this all happened at about midnight because, you know, we were procrastinating going to bed. And then both of us could not sleep a wink that night because we kept thinking, what if we bought it? What if we bought it? We could do this. Nobody else was looking at this place. And the fear was that it was going to get bought by a development company and turned into luxury apartments. Mm-hmm. But my husband and I pulled it together, sold our house, cashed in all our investments, and bought this building. We knew that we needed to build an apartment on top of the theater space to live in. And the theater space itself was not very well built and really needed to be gutted and started from scratch anyway. Mm-hmm. So to build an apartment on top, we had to do all of this foundation work. And during the foundation work, during construction, this would have been in 2016 by this point, we discovered two Revolutionary War era privies or toilet pits filled with artifacts, hundreds of pieces of ceramic and glass and animal bones and bits and pieces from the 1770s. Quite accurately dated, because after we excavated them and cleaned them up, the archaeologists were able to date very accurately several of our pieces. So
this is your other life. As I'm looking around this fantastic apartment, she has beautiful, almost all put together pieces of pottery.
Yeah.
Beautiful bottles, light green, dark blue bottles. Tell us about the stoneware that has the red slip on it.
So there's really, there's several different types of pottery that has come out of the ground here. A lot of it is made in Britain because, of course, Great Britain was importing a lot of their goods to the colonies and forcing them to buy them at marked up prices, which is the reason we fought a revolutionary war. But Philadelphians, when they arrived, realized that there was some amazing red clay here in the ground in Pennsylvania, which anybody who's ever tried to make a garden in the ground in Pennsylvania will immediately discover this mass of red clay. And so they made a lot of utilitarian pottery called redware. It's called redware because the clay is red. Mm-hmm. It's the same clay that bricks are made out of. Mm-hmm. So it's got that texture to it. And so we found a lot of redware inside our privy. It's decorated with a runnier glaze called slip that they drip in stripes across and around the redware and then fired very simply. Mm-hmm. And they would have used it for most of their food service back then.
Yeah, quite beautiful.
I love the redware the most. It's so funny because, you know, the British stuff is clearly better made. It's made in, you know, factories like the Wedgwood factory or Staffordshire factories that had been doing ceramics for a long time by this point. Whereas the Philadelphian potters were using rudimentary tools and were just kind of making stuff to use. They weren't trying to make fancy wares to export, most of them. But the redware, the rudeness of the redware means that you can see the fingerprints of the potters in the outside clay. And to me, that is so much cooler, that sign of humanity on the outside of the clay than something that's perfectly smooth and round and almost machined looking. So we have all of these pots, hundreds and hundreds of pieces of pottery. And now my husband and I are in touch with members of the National Park Service and archaeologists up and down the East Coast. And I'm trying
who are very interested in everything that you
found. Who've been extremely excited. And several of our pieces are apparently very important to this period. So we have this bifurcated existence where on one hand, I'm trying to be a composer and write all of this political vocal music. And on the other hand, I've become an amateur archaeologist, both my husband and I. We have a podcast in which we tell the full story. This was such an abridged version that I just said.
So you'll want to tune into that. How do they find you there?
You can find us on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Google Play or Spotify. And it's called The Bog House. Bog House is one word. B-O-G-H-O-U-S-E. We were also recently featured on 6ABC News because of all of our finds. Wow. And that story might go national on an ABC news television show. So
that is so exciting.
I know. It's so much fun.
So I asked Melissa if there was a way that these two worlds could come together. So I'm not going to give away too much, but we're hoping sometime in the future that her archaeologist and her composer existence are going to meet.
I think so.
There's something really fabulous and exciting. So yeah. Stay tuned.
Yeah, keep an eye out. And, we're calling the building the Hannah Callowhill Stage. When we finish the theater, it's going to open as the Hannah Callowhill Stage. And that should give you a hint as to...
You might want to just tell them about Hannah.
Hannah Callowhill was William Penn's second wife. Towards the end of William Penn's life, he had a very debilitating stroke and had to be looked after. And Hannah, his wife, became the acting proprietor of the colony of Pennsylvania. When Penn died, he actually left the proprietorship of Pennsylvania to his wife in his will. And so she retained that acting proprietor status. His sons from his first wife, from his first marriage, fought her in court and tried to take it away from her because they said she was a woman and she couldn't possibly run the colony, which she had been doing already for 8 years. Mm. She fought them in court and won. So for 14 years until her death, 6 years after Penn died, for 14 years, Hannah Callowhill was America's first female governor. Mm. And she's been forgotten. She's been totally forgotten. So you're
going to tell her story.
Yeah, I have a mission to inform the world that in the early 1700s, we had an amazing, competent woman who was running a colony, a huge colony in the United States. And I hope that you know, if we think about that story, maybe we'll be ready in the 21st century to let more women into power in this country.
On that note,
I'm
going to press the button that stops this fabulous time together.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.